Chickenfightingnetwork.com.
Hello to everybody. Thank you for joining me here on this Monday, December 12th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next 90 minutes or so as we go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me to kick off a new week of the shows here. As always, we've got two fantastic guests on this Monday broadcast. We'll be joined by Joe Everett of NFL Draft Bible for our NFL Week in Review and Monday Night Football Preview. Lots to talk about here from Week 14. Also have to wrap it up tonight with Baltimore against New England. And then the second part of today's show, a full hour with Kyle Hunter of huntersportspicks.com. We'll chat college football and our college football first look, looking at the first round of bowl games coming up here on Saturday. And then we'll also take a deep dive into college basketball. During that segment, we'll give you some games that are on the horizon. Also, a couple of long-term things that will help you with your college basketball handicapping. So without further ado, we'll bring in today's first guest. That is Mr. Joseph Everett of NFL Draft Bible. Joe, how's it going today, man?
Super. I just had a great weekend. Basketball, football, UFC. It was pretty lucrative. Hoping to just duplicate it. And boy, I just honestly, Adam, I hope the books do not outlaw teasers because, wow, they have been very profitable.
And that was something that we talked about on last week's shows. With the tightening, you would think, of the NFL market here late in the season, teasers certainly going to provide some value. And as you mentioned, you know, that was definitely the case yesterday with a lot of teams and over-under situations coming in very nicely there. I guess the place to start here on today's segment, we'll go ahead and start with the Monday Night Football game. We've kind of been doing that here over the last few weeks. But you've got the Baltimore Ravens down to as low as a six-point dog now at Greek and Pinnacle, a couple of the sharper shops out there, as they take on the New England Patriots.
Hard to believe, and it's picking up so much for the Ravens. I think two similar teams here. It's really the Ravens, they're on that tear. They're playing physical football. The guy that sets the tone and one of the best guards in the league, Marshall Yanda, I think some limited practice, but he should be good to go. And then everybody knows about Flacco. I think the development here is the guys they've got on the perimeter are starting to play really well. You know, Mike Wallace is doing his thing, but Breshad Perriman, they're finally getting what they invested in this kid. You know, son of Brent Perriman, he's got the bloodline, Central Florida, rumored to have run a 4.21 at his pro day. So that's why his stock just rose so high, but basically took a red shirt his rookie year. No one got to see anything from him, and now he's really performed kind of as billed. You get the ball in his hands and he can just explode. But I'll tell you, the X factor is the renaissance of one Dennis Pitta. Just when you counted him out, they're going to him early and often. He's always had a great rapport with Joe Flacco. I believe the two are still, you know, roommates on the road, pretty tight like that. But he's got game. And it's another funny thing, you know, the Ravens have invested a lot in tight end. I think second rounder Max Williams out of Minnesota, another guy, done little to nothing thus far. I think he's on IR this year too. So they're really blessed to get what they've gotten out of Pitta, in my opinion. So the Patriots, their only course for action, I think, is, you know, they're known for switching fronts. They go even and odd all times. I think this might be the time to go do a little more two gap and line five across, and more of a traditional 3-4, and they've got a lot of new linebackers in the mix, and they could take advantage of that right side. I think Zutov, Vladimir Dacos, and Ricky Wagner, those are the guys that are beatable, and you know, people look at them letting Jamie Collins go in that trade. I think the two guys they got running are just as good as Shane McClellan and Kyle Van Noy. They're playing really well. They're actually playing more snaps than anybody in that front seven, last I checked, in that last game, so I think what they've got to do is really vary it up, get super creative. They're doing really good in the secondary. I mean, these four guys have been doing it for the last 2 years, and those safeties, Chung and McCourty, they know this system like the back of their hand. So I'm not too worried about Flacco going off, but I am worried about Dennis Pitta. I think that's the guy. They're going to work it to him early and often. And then the Pats on offense, I think the Ravens, they've got an ability to shut down that running game. The size advantage alone with those two, Jernigan and Brandon Williams, just what a monster he is. Of another guy, just about a wide around as a Coke machine, and he makes it real tough on the interior. But I think Baltimore, what they've done this year, And everyone's like, what has changed? It's the back half in that secondary. Eric Weddle has been a blessing. That, if anyone remembers last season, the Ravens' Achilles heel was that secondary getting burned, and safety was a huge issue. Well, with Weddle, the bearded wonder, patrolling the field, that's now a strength for them. So if Terrell Suggs is just moderately healthy, what they've got from Zach Orr, and Mosley out of Alabama, there's just, I think, a lot of teeth on this defense finally. So the Pats, really what they're going to have to do, I think, they're going to have a limited Martellus Bennett with the Zach Orr and Mosley just on him in coverage. They're going to be forced to really get Julian Edelman open in the short game. And if they have an X factor here, Adam, I'd look at rookie Malcolm Mitchell winning on the perimeter. That's, if they could get him matched up with Sharice Wright, the weak link in this Ravens secondary, that's where they might be able to get a little bit of win. And so if I had to, I don't know, predict the Gruden grinder here, I would go with rookie Malcolm Mitchell, because he's really starting to come along. He's beating man press, and everyone knew he had talent coming out of Georgia. He's got the speed. It's just the consistency is really starting to show. I'm hoping he doesn't hit any kind of rookie wall, because the Pats need him bad in this game.
Well, and for Baltimore here, I mean, the defense, obviously the story. They're first in points against, first in yards against, first in first downs against, also one of the best rushing defenses in the league, as you mentioned already. But it's the offense here that is something that we need to monitor. I mean, in terms of the AFC teams that are in the playoff mix, Baltimore certainly appears to have one of, if not the best defense. But offensively, you know, this is a team that's first in passing yards, or passing attempts, excuse me, but just 10th in yards and 20th in touchdowns. So, you know, for Baltimore here, not a real efficient offensive performance. They swapped out Mark Trestman for Marty Morningwig earlier in the season. Have you seen this offense grow at all under Morningwig? And if so, in what areas have they improved?
I think it is in the passing game. And it's hard to imagine, because Trestman is known as a guru. He's known as a bit of a quarterback whisperer. But Morningwig, no slouch, traditional West Coast kind of approach. And I think that's been better for this team, whereas Trestman, I think a little bit more man block, a little bit more power scheme in the run. And this seems to just jive with a lot of the skill position players. I mean, they've got some veteran leadership, so you wouldn't think it'd be as big an issue. I think where it's really shown up is in the line and the usage. I think it's really the usage of Pitta. You don't see all that tight end play to start out the year. I know Pitta wasn't 100% to begin this season either. It's still, I think that's where it happens in the playbook, a little bit more involvement of Kyle Juszczyk at the fullback position. And those guys as receivers are making a difference, I think, in Morningwig's system, because that is where it all started. You know, even dating back to that West Coast, is you'll not only needed that receiving back, but you also needed a fullback that could do a little bit of both too.
Well, let's take a look here at the Patriots offense, because they do have a very tough assignment here going up against Baltimore. You mentioned the importance of Martellus Bennett, but Bennett will play tonight. He's not 100%. It seems like the Patriots are going to monitor his workload a little bit, and you can't blame them for that with Rob Gronkowski already out. And then, of course, Danny Amendola out with the high ankle sprain. So for this Patriots team, sitting here at 10-2, they're going to win this division. You know, maybe they do kind of take it a little bit easier here in some of these games in terms of the snap counts for key players. But, you know, this is a team that, I mean, that, look, they're 7-1 since Tom Brady came back. They've had some big-time blowout victories in that span. Everything seems to be clicking pretty well for the Patriots here, but you talked about them not being able to get the running game going here in this one. You know, what do they need to do in order to have success with that?
They need to throw more and set the run up with the pass is what I try and do. And I think you're right to worry about Bennett being banged up and that even limited more of his impact. So they're going to be forced to get guys like, well, at least Deion Lewis is back in the mix, but I still like James White, James Sweetfeet White out of Wisconsin. That kid, a lot of talent, really good receiver, and if they could just get those linebackers on their heels for a second, that would allow them to get a little bit more breathing room. But still, it's I think it's all predicated on the short pass. If they want to run and if they want to win in short yardage, just because this front seven right now, just talk about things clicking. All those guys, I won't call them 100% healthy. I honestly think Terrell Suggs playing with one arm. But even a one-armed Terrell Suggs, he's still half a hacksaw, and that's good enough for me. I think, yeah, that's it's really just going to be tough sledding between the tackles with this those two defensive linemen they have. I think they could start on any team. And right now, yeah, this Baltimore defense, like I mentioned, they just have teeth. So they're forced to go short pass, and they really need to win against Jimmy Smith and Sharice Wright out there. Otherwise, they're going to be in a lot of trouble. And what's the problem has been, I still think, you know, you look at what has the difference been for Baltimore, I still think it's these safeties playing as well as they have. Not only has Weddle done really well, but the last couple of games I've seen Ladarius Webb make some game-changing plays. That interception he had against Miami, that really set the tone for that game.
Well, I guess all that's left to do here is decide which one of these sides you like here in this spot. We've seen a little bit of the line value lost, as I mentioned here, on Baltimore, down to 6 at the sharper books. There's still 6.5 out there at the crisp books, including BSI Sportsbook. Bovada, the only one out there I still see with a 7. Not really a big surprise there, given, you know, how they tend to look at their betting populace. So with that in mind, which side do you like here? I think it sounds like you've kind of tipped your hand a little bit, but who are you looking at tonight?
Play it safe and take the points. I'm leaning Ravens here, Adam, and you know, we talk about teasers so much. I think a nice safe play might just take your side Ravens, add your 6.5, and take your under 45 and bump it up to 50-something. It might be a nice little safe play. It's just boy, those Ravens are playing tough, and I know listeners are rolling their eyes. Oh, you want me to fade the Patriots? Well, this is just a tough situational spot and that really gnarly defense. So, yeah, I tend to side with defense, and if you're going to give me a touchdown, I might just improve my odds there. And, yeah, like I said, tease those Ravens.
All right, well, we'll look at what happened during the rest of NFL Week 14 here. We'll begin with one of the 4:30 kickoffs, at least for the East Coast people. You've got Atlanta here, who completely blew out the Rams. I mean, this was a 42-14 game that's not even as close as the score would suggest, because the Rams got a couple of fourth quarter garbage time touchdowns. But this was a game that I felt like Atlanta really needed. They needed to come out here and play very well, beat up on a wounded opponent. You know, this is part of the maturation process for a team, and you know this from being around coaches and players all the time. It feels like this is something that Dan Quinn needed, because this is a team that really hasn't played up to its potential over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, not at all. And, you know, they had that rough out against Kansas City, and I think that's fresh in their minds. So that you're right, confidence. And I think a point I would stress, I'm trying to stress in this episode, is pride from a player's perspective. You know, they want to get better. They are still improving. And this season, I still think on offense, a confidence-building win is what this was, what they did without Julio. Most teams, if they lose an A1, a wide receiver like a Julio Jones, their offense just goes right in the tank, and they're just playing ball control, and that's far from it. This offense is still hotter than fish grease. I mean, they're scheming. The fundamentals they're working on, it seems all levels it's really clicking, not just the line, but the ancillary receivers. What Taylor Gabriel is starting to do out of nowhere, I mean, I think that really – You got to shout out the coaches on that one. And I know your listeners, please forgive me, but and I know I broke a record, but this Kyle Shanahan offense, he's taken that old West Coast for those old stretches and the sprint right goes and those bootlegs. Now he's incorporated a lot of jet sweeps, some real trap runs off of motion up into the inside. And what I'm seeing is a lot of variance from the Saturday ball, honestly. And I applaud the efforts just to upgrade what is already a really effective scheme, because, you know, the zone blocking up front's the same. It's just got a different flair in the approach, the lines and the sets. You just can't be – I can't say enough about this offense, especially those running backs. They've got a lot of talent there. The issue with the Falcons team, of course, they're real thin at corner. They lost Trufant. Robert Alford's playing real well, but losing Jamie Collins in this last game, Jalen Collins, that might be an issue, because they're, like I said, the real thin depth is a problem there. So, but otherwise, the Seattle scheme is working. They seem to have adapted here, and really, if you're looking at the most dangerous team in the NFC, it used to be Dallas. A lot of people wanted to talk about Seattle. I think if once the playoffs start, Adam, I'm really staring at the Falcons thinking they've got a ton of ways they can beat you.
Well, of course, for the Falcons here in this game, they certainly took advantage of the 5 turnovers that the Rams gifted them. But at the same time, I mean, we've seen week after week here in the NFL where teams get turnovers and they don't cash them in. And it's very, very important, you know, to cash in those opportunities. Of course, a couple defensive scores here for the Falcons in this game as well. But, you know, again, to be a good team in the NFL, you have to take advantage of situations and games that play out like this, and the Falcons certainly did that. One other thing I want to ask you about with the Falcons here, Vic Beasley, what a game for him yesterday. 3 sacks, 3 tackles for loss, had a scoop and score there as well. You know, obviously, this is a Falcons defense that has pieces and parts, and they've been waiting to sort of put all of them together. You mentioned the depth is certainly an issue for them this season. What is this a defense that can stack up against, say, a Dallas or a Seattle, you know, or maybe or one of the wild card teams?
I think it is, as long as they keep buying in, because this front 7 has gotten a lot better from last year's version. And Vic Beasley coming on, I got to credit his work with Dwight Freeney, veterans like Adrian Claiborne. I think he's getting some, you know, I'm sure he's getting some great coaching, you know. Say what you want about Smith, but Brian Cox, the defensive line coach there, I think he's just surrounded in a really good situation. If, like you mentioned, they get this defense humming, there's a couple players that if they start playing as well as they should, Keanu Neal, that safety, I think is just a budding superstar and a blow-up artist, a tattoo artist without the ink, I like to say, because he's going to leave a mark after you play the Falcons. So there's a lot of nice pieces on defense. If they could just catch up to the offense, yeah, they're going to be able to sustain themselves, and they're going to be able to just at least keep up their end of the bargain, because like I mentioned, if it's the running game, if it's the passing game, it's so impressive that they did what they did, and they are now at a level to where they don't need Julio Jones to blow up for 200 yards every single week. They just need him out there, and they're a complete team.
One last thing I want to ask you about in terms of this game, and it's not on the Falcons. I know that you wanted to talk about them, and deservedly so, but Jared Goff, 24-41 for 235, couple picks, 3 sacks. Not a particularly strong game for him, obviously, from a statistical standpoint, but what did you see in his development? Did you see anything that looked promising?
It's tough to gauge what he's got with the offensive line in front of him, especially in a game like this. People are flying in front of his face. There's no throwing lanes, and you really do have to start questioning the coaching he's getting with the Rams. Chris Winkie, you know, known to be a little bit of a guru, and he works with a lot of draft prospects. I think he's got his own academy, but at the pro level, what is going on here? And yeah, you got to question that extension they gave Fisher. But be that as it may, I still think they got a prospect in Goff. It's just get him the help, and I don't want to say invest more in the offensive line, because they've got a lot of high round picks. I mean, Roger Saffold, memory serves, as a second rounder. Greg Robinson was a high first rounder out of Auburn. And I still think Jamon Brown has some potential, but it's just, yeah, the wrong mix. And I am totally putting this coaching staff right under the bus in this situation. I think if you're just willing to give Goff a pass this season and just go with what it's some potential for next year, it's almost at this point hard to gauge what to make of the kid, just because, you know, coming out of that system with Sonny Dykes and now being thrown in, you know, I guess you could call it a system in LA. So it's, I have to give him an incomplete, and that I can't give him a letter grade.
Well, we'll move to the Lake Effect Snow game in Buffalo here. This was a very fun one to watch on TV. Probably not a very fun one to play in, unless, of course, you were Le'Veon Bell, who had a monster day. 298 total yards, 38 carries for 236, 4 catches for 62 more, had 3 touchdowns, and that was something that the Steelers needed, because Ben Roethlisberger was just 17 of 21 with 3 picks here in this one. You liked what you saw from the Steelers despite that ugly line from Roethlisberger.
Well, I like what I see, but I think that defense is a big issue and a handicap for them. For looking at the postseason, that's going to be a a problem going forward. No Cameron Hayward. The cornerbacks are junk and the decline of Lawrence, his fall in play, I think, is really it's showing this year in a drastic way. So he's really now just a liability. I think this entire defense right now is prone to the big play. So, yeah, Steelers overs are looking like a really nice side. But, you got to love what you saw out of Le'Veon Bell. The Death Star, I like to call him, because when he's at 100% capacity, you're just not stopping him. But what happens when they neutralize that running game and Roethlisberger with his play, looking at his road games, I mean, just the last two games he's thrown four picks. And outside of those two scrimmages against JV squads, Indianapolis and Cleveland, they don't really have a lot of quality wins, the Steelers. So I like them the rest of the way out in the regular season. I think they're going to win, and maybe they qualify for the playoffs. But what they're going to do forward, and, yeah, next week they even have a tough cover in Tyler Eifert. You know, maybe Shazier is able to run with them, but if they get Eifert on Timmons and the defense of the Bengals and that rivalry, they may have a really little bit of tough sledding next week. So, yeah, Ben Roethlisberger's drop-off in play definitely has been a major concern.
Have the injuries finally caught up with him? I mean, is this an issue with his legs, with some of the, you know, the problems that he's had there with his knees, or is it an arm talent thing? What does it look like to you?
I think it's injuries and age a little bit. I mean, you remember Roethlisberger coming out. He was always able to have that moving pocket. He's been so strong, and, you know, you survey any of his defenders in the NFL, who's the toughest to take down? Right now it'd still probably be Roethlisberger by default, even though Cam Newton's getting a lot of votes. But he's certainly first, if you're calling roll in that regard. And now it's starting to fall off a little bit, I think, his mobility and just the explosion he's able to get out of a standstill position. I think that's changed a lot. And also arm strength. I'm wondering where that's at this point in his career. Maybe it's just these bad weather games really affected him. I don't know that it's been an issue in the past. So I would look at more just being a little long in the tooth. It's just a little drop off and a little more inconsistencies. But yeah, it's a major red flag when it's against teams like the Bills. And now, I guess, you know, throwing an interception against the Giants, as we found out last night, that defense is not too shabby. So, you know, you could excuse that. But, yeah, this last week, it definitely sets off some alarm bells. And while they may keep winning out, I would be leery of them in a postseason situation.
Well, despite the loss here, you still think that there's a little bit of value on the Buffalo Bills. Now, they gave up 5.7 yards per carry in this game on 42 tries, so they didn't have the ball a whole lot on offense. Shady McCoy really couldn't get going, just 2.3 yards per carry. But you are seeing some buy signs here for Buffalo.
Looking for value, I'm sure the group's out of playoff contention, and they may or may not lose their head coach today or tomorrow. I'm staying out of that. There's just still talent on the team, and I think a few guys that could really play. And, yeah, they intercepted Roethlisberger, but there's one factor. These guys still have pride. They're still playing for their own careers, and I hate to hear that talk of, like, oh, this entire team has given up. They're playing out the string, especially in the pro ranks, because, well, there's guys like Kyle Williams on this team, a veteran, and one day I think he's going to be a great coach, whatever the level he chooses to coach, because he's intense, he cares, he lives this game, and he's going to hold people accountable. I mean, he's injured right now. I don't think Kyle Williams plays next week, but I don't even think that matters, because he's going to get into somebody's face, he's going to preach the cause, and he's going to get them dead right for the next series, or there's going to be hell to pay. So I think there's too many veterans on this team for to roll over and die. Just a lot of guys that are going to be playing for Rex. There's guys just going to be playing defense for each other. And if you want to be 110, there's guys playing for their next contract. There's likely to be a new GM, maybe a new coach. So you really have to get a bit of an audition tape out there. So, yeah, their offense is hit and miss, but I like this defense. As you mentioned, if they get Shady McCoy going, he was basically shut out of that last game, and that's the strength and focal point of their offense. So I think these last three games, you know, I just admitted I hate saying this team is playing out the string, but they have games against the Browns, the Dolphins, the Jets. I'd be leaning pretty hard Buffalo, I think, the rest of the way.
One more team that you wanted to touch on here, and that's the Seattle Seahawks, who had to turn the ball over 6 times yesterday, 5 of them Russell Wilson interceptions. I was happy about it because Cole Ryan and I had the Green Bay Packers in the Super Contest this week. But, you know, for Seattle here, I mean, I sort of thought that this was a little bit of a schedule loss because they've got a 3-game lead in the NFC West. You know, they're going to win this week against the Rams on a short week. They're probably going to beat the 49ers here at the end of the year. So, you know, they should have the division locked up. They are playing for the number 2 seed if they care about that. But that being said, even if this is a game that they don't come fully focused for, that they don't bring a full effort, losing 38-10 with 6 turnovers is embarrassing.
It's embarrassing, and we talk about confidence-building wins. I think this is a deflating loss for that defense and realizing that, well, sure, Cam Chancellor, he's that alpha male, the machismo, he brings that intensity, but the athleticism and boy wonder was Earl Thomas, that eraser that he is and how quickly he recovers and the special athlete, losing that in the back half, they knew it. The Packers knew it. All the fans knew it. Dogs outside the stadium could smell it. And I think they're in real trouble without Earl Thomas. And, yeah, like you mentioned, they're just showing total give up, I think, a situational scheduling spot to where kind of like with Wyoming and San Diego State, they got the Mountain West locked up in college, and the game before the championship, they just both throw in the towel. I mean, it's very similar to that. So I'm sure you could do it, and yes, they may win out, but I think even if they do win their last 3, and even if they do it in impressive fashion, I would watch this defense along the way. They don't scare me one bit in the playoffs, especially if they lose that Quest Field advantage and have to go on the road. And, yeah, I would just stress it again. If I'm taking anything away from last week, is that Dallas showed some chinks in the armor, and the Seattle Seahawks are not the team we thought they were, and right now I'm buying Falcons stock hard.
I guess the question here then about Seattle is, you know, as I talked about, I mean, this is a team that was in a tough spot. They knew it. They expected it. They had to go play a cold weather game. I know Russell Wilson played a season at Wisconsin there in Madison, but, you know, still cold weather games certainly affect quarterbacks in a pretty big way. Can they turn this thing around on a short week to go out there and blow out a Rams team that they're favored by 14 against?
I would be leery of them covering that number, but I do believe they're gonna get a lot of good mojo going back at home. And yeah, this is a bit of a bottom feeder that has no cohesion on offense, so they'll pull it together for a win. But yeah, like I mentioned, I wouldn't trust them to cover that 14 straight away, and also playing against an Arizona Cardinals team that knows them well. I think that's a snake in the grass game right there. So going the rest of the way, they're going to be a playoff team. I think we could just reside to that, but it's just, I think there's a lot of foe to this Seattle team going forward.
And it seems like for Seattle right now, I mean, I know Russell Wilson threw 5 picks in this game, but he was under duress for a decent amount of it. This Seahawks offensive line has been a problem area, not just this season, but last season as well. Are you seeing any growth? Are you seeing, you know, any sorts of improvements from this group? Or, you know, is this a team that you, if they do get the wrong matchup in the playoffs, where they do face a really strong defensive line, would you look to fade them almost based solely on that?
Well, especially the matchup. If you see them, like I mentioned, Arizona Cardinals with a guy like Calais Campbell, Chandler Jones coming off the edge, they've got a lot of talent in that front 7. That's a situation I would look to go against the Seahawks team. And it's so a shame, Adam. I had the biggest hopes for this George Fant, the basketball player out of Western Kentucky. He didn't even catch a pass. They tried him at tight end for the Hilltoppers. They've tried him, you know, they've worked him in at left tackle. It's just the last couple of games, he's been a bit of a liability. He's gotten some situational spots where he's gotten beat. I mean, just lost it versus man, and it wasn't a double. It wasn't a scheme. I think especially in this game, he had a ton of issues against those Packers edge rushers, and I don't even look at them as being super talented. So that is a huge matchup point going forward for them, because you just have to account for a guy that's basically playing his rookie year in college in the NFL right now in Fant with a lack of experience. So I think teams, they've really discovered some tape on him, and they're finding out ways to beat him. So if Seattle doesn't get that solved, yeah, you could look to really take advantage of that matchup.
A lot of excellent insights today, as always, from Joe Everett of NFL Draft Bible. Joe, what's going on over there at the website?
Well, we got our bowl previews, cranking those out. We're putting the finishing touches on the College Gridiron Showcase roster, working feverishly on that. But go to the site. You can read our risers, the sliders. We've got the big board, the mock draft. We've got you covered all the way to Philadelphia for this draft. That's right. It's going to be in the city of brotherly love. And I heard a rumor, Adam, my old stomping grounds, went to college 4 years in Philadelphia. So I may be, they just gave me an excuse to go back to my second home. Might be covering it live this year.
Very nice. And they do tremendous work over there at NFL Draft Bible. Some of it, of course, behind a paywall, but very, very well worth it. They have comprehensive coverage on so many different things. I know that there are a lot of NFL draft nicks out there that want all that information. So head on over to NFL Draft Bible. Follow Joe on Twitter at Joe W. Everett. Follow NFL Draft Bible on Twitter at NFL Draft Bible. Joe, thank you so much for your time as always, man. We'll talk to you again next week.
All right. Looking forward to it, Adam.
Well, great stuff there with Joe Everett coming out of a very interesting week 14 in the NFL, and something that I'll want to talk about with our guests here as we go throughout the week, something we didn't discuss there during that segment, is I watched a lot of that Cowboys game last night against the New York Giants, and Cole Ryan and I have been talking about this, and I didn't think that this would be the week that it would happen, but we've been discussing throughout our Gridiron Gambling Report segments and also on our Super Contest segments is, you know, what happens when Dak Prescott has to go out and win a game for Dallas? Well, we saw a little bit of it last night. That was an awful fourth quarter from Dak Prescott. Really, it was a terrible fourth quarter from both quarterbacks because Eli looked awful in that game as well. But, you know, the Cowboys certainly do have some concerns. And Joe was talking about, you know, we saw some deficiencies from them last night. Of course, we saw some deficiencies, you know, from Seattle in their loss. So, really looks like the NFC very wide open now at this stage of the game. And, you know, maybe it was just a schedule type of thing here late in the season. You know, both of those teams, Dallas and Seattle, have a decent chance of getting bye weeks here as we go along. So we'll see what happens with all of this. But, you know, the fact remains, it was a very interesting week 14 there in the NFL, and we still have one more game left to go here for this week. Before we bring Kyle Hunter in for a full hour with our college football first look and also our Handicapping the Hardwood segment, just want to remind our listeners here about DSI Sportsbook, the BTB Radio promo code. Get you a $10 free bet just for signing up, an additional 50 to 100% deposit bonus based on the amount of your initial deposit. You know, it's that time of year where you're shopping around for Christmas gifts. You want to shop around for the best numbers as well, whether it's a money line sport like the NHL, whether you're looking at futures prices for college hoops, college football, you know, the NFL, game-by-game lines, all of that. You want to make sure that you have multiple sports books at your disposal. And if DSI isn't one of them, we certainly recommend that they become one. So with that, we'll go to our next set of segments here. That is with Mr. Kyle Hunter of huntersportspicks.com. Kyle, how's it going today, man?
It's going all right, man. A little bit under the weather here today, so apologize if my voice breaks up here, losing my voice a little bit, so hopefully we can hold up here for an hour. Coming off a top play winner on the Army-Navy under this weekend, and have to say I loved watching that game because two rooting interests in that game. The under is a better, and Army as a fan, love seeing them get that win.
Yeah, it was definitely a really emotional scene, and it's great for them and for those players for sure. And, I mean, we talked about it, you know, with several handicappers last week on the show. If Army was going to do it, that set up is the spot for them to do it because Navy coming off that conference championship game, they lose their quarterback and one of their top running backs. It was all set up for Army, and they had to earn it, but they did. Now I guess the question becomes this. You know, obviously this is looking a little bit further ahead. We're not going to talk about this game here on today's show, but does that make Army a fade against North Texas in your mind, or does enough time pass to where, you know, they should come down from that high of beating Navy?
Well, a couple things about that. You know, number one, I would normally want to fade a team after a huge win like that. But a service academy, I feel like it's a little bit different. You know, we've talked about this some before that, you know, the service academies are really good at getting up for every game. So I think there's a little bit less of a letdown factor for them. They also lost to North Texas earlier this year, so that makes it even more complicated handicap. So I got to look at that game some more. I'm sure we'll talk about it more. But just in general, I wouldn't look to fade Army as quick as I would another team in that situation.
Well, we're going to talk about the five games coming up here on Saturday. I guess we'll also touch on the Monday game on the 19th because we'll be on the show next week here. So we won't have a whole lot of lead time for that Central Michigan versus Tulsa game, so we'll touch on that one as well. But before we get to the bowl games that we're going to discuss here specifically, not a ton of movement out there in the market. You know, I think we're kind of waiting now until the week of the game or maybe a few days out before the game when limits get increased. But anything notable out there that you've, you know, read, picked up on, seen a line movement for, anything like that that you want to discuss?
I think an interesting game as far as the money movement thus far, I like seeing what's happening with the Florida State and Michigan line. Just on my power rankings, I think that line may be a little bit heavy there with Michigan. And I'm really curious to see what kind of line movement we see with that game. I think that's a really, really interesting game. It's obviously a neutral site, but a lot closer to Florida State. Michigan laying in touchdown there. I've noticed the totals dropped 4 points in that game. I think that's a good move there. And I think that just in general, I'd look to see – I'm very curious to see whether somebody's going to be willing to step up and take the touchdown, Florida State plus 7, because I think it's hard to lay a bunch of points in a game that you think will be relatively low scoring. And I think Florida State's upside is extremely high. So that's one that I really want to keep an eye on. There hasn't really been a big move on the side, but the total has dropped 4 points.
Yeah, I'm really interested in that game as well because you have two very visible public types of teams here in this matchup, and one of them's catching 7 points. And when you look at how the bowl matchups shake out here, I know that this game's on December 30th, but yeah, I was talking about with Brent from DSI Sportsbook about this last week. I have to think that aside from the two semifinal games in the national championship, that Florida State-Michigan game will probably have the highest handle of the bowl season. So I will be very intrigued to see if we get sharp action on one side or another, and I would assume the sharp action would come in on Florida State. But I'm also intrigued to see what the public move is going to be there on December 30th.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that's hard to gauge who the public's going to be on in that game. So we'll see what happens with that one. One I did want to point out here, Pittsburgh really catching a lot of money here. Pittsburgh's gone from -4 up to 5.5 against Northwestern. 79% of the bets on Pittsburgh and 84% of the money on Pittsburgh so far. So no real sign of that one going back the other way. So I guess if you like Pittsburgh, you probably want to go ahead and play it now. But that's an interesting line move. You know, I think Pat Narduzzi's team is getting a little bit of love because of who they have beaten so far this year.
That's an interesting point because we talk about motivation. We, you know, sort of look at the matchups and all this. And I think that's something we need to touch on here a little bit is you have very different levels of competition for some of these teams. And you have a situation here where, I mean, the ACC and the Big Ten are pretty comparable overall, but you know, you do have this Pitt team that has beaten, you know, a quality Clemson team, also beat Penn State earlier in the year. You know, Northwestern doesn't have those signature wins. You know, does that matter when you talk about the bowl season?
Yeah, I think it matters. Yeah, I do. I think they've proven that their upside is really high. Northwestern's a tricky team for me to handicap. I'll be honest, I'll be surprised if I have a play on this game. Pitt's pass defense is so bad. I mean, they've just given up so many yards through the air this year. They're good run defense. The problem is, can Northwestern exploit that pass defense weakness? I'm not sure if they can or not. I guess my slight lean would be to Pitt as well. I do think it matters what a team shows as their highest upside. Northwestern's been really inconsistent this year. There have been times throughout the season that they look like a team that could be really good. They gave Ohio State all they wanted, that's for sure. At other times, Northwestern's been a pretty big disappointment. So I think they're a little bit of a hard team to figure out.
One other bowl team I want to talk about, and then one team that's not, well, I guess this one could possibly affect, what's going on with bowl preparation, but South Florida. So this is a spot where South Florida playing in the Birmingham Bowl could have been down a little bit. You know, Willie Taggart makes his move out to Oregon, and you can't fault him for that. But, you know, it could have been a spot where South Florida came in, you know, a little bit deflated, a little bit let down. But then I think they made a phenomenal hire with Charlie Strong. So is that something that picks South Florida's stock back up a little bit? You think maybe we see a little bit of a move on the Bulls here now?
You know, I don't know. I see the money here so far. Bet percentage, 57%. Money, 77% on South Carolina. So it looks like some people, some sharps have been looking to fade South Florida based off the fact that they lost Taggart. But, you know, I do agree with you that that was a good hire in Charlie Strong, first of all, especially for recruiting purposes. I mean, he knows Florida extremely well. You have to think he's going to get some really good players there into South Florida. And it's tough to lose a guy like Taggart. He did a really good job there at USF, but I think Strong will do a good job as well. You got to remember, too, South Florida has a really, really good backfield in Quentin Flowers and Marlon Mack. South Carolina, I think, has Jake Bentley, a guy who has a really high upside for the future, but he doesn't have the players around him that Flowers does at USF. You know, I'm kind of hoping they push that line down because I kind of like to take South Florida in that spot if I can lay under 10 points. So we'll see what happens to that line.
And then, of course, the other big coaching news here today, this one doesn't necessarily impact the bowl period too much, but Lane Kiffin going to Florida Atlantic, which I think is a very intriguing fit because we all know the recruiting hotbed that Florida is. There's a ton of talent there. And some of it's going to want to play for Lane Kiffin. And Kiffin, I think this is a good move for him because it's a spot where he can go in there and have success relatively quickly, use it as a springboard to go somewhere else. Now, he said he's going to remain as Alabama's offensive coordinator for the college football playoff and throughout the preparation period. So I don't think it affects the Crimson Tide too much. But what do you think about Kiffin going to FAU here?
Well, a couple thoughts about this one. You know, about a week ago, the reports were that it was a done deal that he was going to Houston, and then it turned out not to be the case. And then I know he was interested in the South Florida job. Obviously, he got a lesser job here at Florida Atlantic. There's no doubt about that. But like you say, I think it actually works out pretty well for him because of the type of opponents he's going to play against. You know, he's not going to play against really good teams there. So if he can recruit some decent talent there, pretty quickly he'll be able to have that team playing pretty well, and it's not going to surprise me at all. You know, I don't really rate him as that good of a head coach until he proves something, but I do think he's going to be able to recruit talent, and they're going to have more talented teams than what they're playing against. So I do think it's fairly likely that Florida Atlantic will turn things around, and then he'll use that as a springboard, like you said, to move to a bigger job.
Well, we'll get to the topics that we had planned to discuss here. Of course, you know, there's always news and things going on, so we want to make sure that we touch on that kind of stuff and keep you prepared. But we'll go start with the Saturday bowl games here. We've got the Gildan New Mexico Bowl between the New Mexico Lobos and the Texas San Antonio Roadrunners. New Mexico's laying 7 here, and what's a home game for them? They seem to play in this bowl every time that they qualify for a bowl game. But for UTSA here, the job that Frank Wilson has done with this program, absolutely phenomenal. I don't know if he got Coach of the Year consideration, but he certainly should have. You know that this is a very motivated UTSA team looking to cover the 7 points here.
Yeah, I think both teams are motivated in this spot. I will say, as a head coach, Bob Davies 0-9 straight up in his last 9. So Davies certainly struggled in these bowl games. Having said that, I have to say Bob Davies done a tremendous job at New Mexico. I've watched them play several times this year, and every time I watch them, I wonder how they've won so many games because that defense is terrible. I mean, that defense is just really, really bad. Give up some huge plays over the top. You know, you just wonder if UTSA is able to take advantage of that weakness in the New Mexico secondary. I don't know if they can or not, but New Mexico, look, the coaching staff knows that their defense is bad. So what do? They run, they go very slowly. They run that option offense. They're averaging 6.98 yards per play. That's 9th best in the country, and they're actually 1st in the country in rushing offense, which is really impressive since usually one of the service academies is that. New Mexico's offense is really, really good. UTSA on defense, you know, they've been pretty good, 58th. in total defense, which honestly is good when you consider a lot of the teams in Conference USA, really high-powered offenses and not very many good defenses there. So UTSA has been able to have some success based on the fact that, you know, defensively, this is a team who has stepped it up quite a bit this year, and I think that's to the credit of Frank Wilson. As far as the side here, you know, I don't really know. I don't have any strong lean on this one. I think 7's a really good number. I guess I would lean to the over on the total. This is going to be a game that I pass on totally. But I think that New Mexico can break some big plays here. You know, UTSA hasn't played against a team that has any kind of an offense or that runs any type of an offense like New Mexico does. And I still think New Mexico will give up some big plays. UTSA, 6 plays of 70 yards or more this year, so they do have an explosive offense as well. So I think you could see some points in this one.
I think the big question from a side standpoint in this game is, you know, we talked about Frank Wilson and the job that he's done, you know, to have instant success here, really. And it was tough for him because Larry Coker kind of abruptly stepped down at UTSA, and you know, they kind of had to scramble to pick up Frank Wilson, who was an assistant there with LSU, and he's done a brilliant job. So the question then becomes here, with some extra prep time here during the you know, the break between the final game of the regular season and the bowl game, you've got November 26th to December 17th. Of course, there's, you know, some fanfare and all that that goes on before the bowl games. But in terms of that, how do you rate Frank Wilson having to go up against this unique triple option, you know, almost a modified triple option type of offense for New Mexico? I think that's the hard part about handicapping this side.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I really don't want any part of it. It's hard to say, really hard to say. Neither one of these teams played a good schedule either this year, 104 and 108 in strength of schedule. So, you know, neither one of these teams are great, but, you know, you have to give them both credit for getting to this point. You know, these are programs that weren't very good at all here a few years ago. I remember how bad New Mexico was when Mike Locksley was the head coach there. So Bob Davies really turned them around in a big way. And UTSA, obviously, you know, nobody expected them to be in a bowl game. I do want to say the money percentages of this one. I want to try to give these on all the games here today. Usually when we do the Monday segment, there's not enough as far as percentages and amount of bets to be able to tell much of anything. But this is some premium data that I hope can help the listeners some. New Mexico, 70% of the bets are on New Mexico here, and 76% of the money's on New Mexico. It's hard to say where this line's going to go because I think 7's a really fair number. I think if you take 7, if you get up to 7.5, somebody's going to take UTSA as a sharp side and want to grab the points. I think if it goes under 7, then it's going to be the same way on New Mexico. So I think 7 is a solid number. 74% of the bets so far on the over. So probably if you like the over, you want to go ahead and take it.
Well, this game here is one of the most fascinating of the bowl season, the Las Vegas Bowl between Houston and San Diego State. So as you mentioned, Houston, they were, you know, connected to several different guys, including Lane Kiffin, and they decided to go in-house with Major Applewhite. I believe, as far as I know, Todd Orlando is still going to be the interim head coach for this game. He's the defensive coordinator. But now that they stay in-house with Applewhite, you know, the players have a little bit more stability, and that was the big worry for Houston coming into this game. Was Tom Herman leaving? How do they respond? How do they react? Well, now, and this is something we talked about last week, you know, the coordinators and the position coaches are the guys that are really out there, you know, pounding the pavement in the recruiting department. The head coaches show up when they need to for those 4 and 5 stars that, you know, have a lot of competing offers. So I think it really benefits Houston here that they hired in-house. Maybe it's not the flashiest hire, but it should be something that does help this team out a little bit. And yet we've seen, you know, some San Diego State money here come in early on this game with Tom Herman leaving. Do you feel like the dynamics are changed now about this game given the coach that Houston hired?
Well, I still think it's a unique situation, you know, have an interim coach for the bowl game only, and then a head coach steps in right after that. You know, you don't see that too often, especially when the guy's already in-house. So, you know, I don't really know what that means for Houston in this game. I do know that, you know, when we talked about this last week, Houston is one of those teams with questionable motivation here coming into the bowl season. This is a team that played in the Peach Bowl last year against Florida State. And after they beat Oklahoma early on, there was a lot of talk about them being a playoff contender. So Houston, you know, you could certainly say that they could be disappointed in ending up at the Las Vegas Bowl. So, you know, I'm curious about that motivation. There's no way I'm laying the points here with Houston. Houston's a better team than San Diego State. There's no doubt about that. But that means less in bowl season than it does throughout the regular season. I think San Diego State will be motivated. Pumphrey's last game, I'll tell you, Donnell Pumphrey, a really good running back. I don't think he ever really got the credit he deserved, partially because he played out on the West Coast and, you know, most people didn't see him play that much, but a really, really good running back. A couple things I want to look at here in this game. Houston is second in the nation in yards per carry allowed, 2.87 yards per carry. Now, that's really important because San Diego State, they run the ball a lot. More than 70% of their plays this year were rushing plays, the sixth highest percentage in the country. And that's even higher than option teams like Georgia Southern and Tulane. So San Diego State is not throwing it around very much at all. They're going to need to be able to run the football. Houston's really good at stopping the run. San Diego State's good at stopping the run as well, and San Diego State has a good secondary. You know, Houston is doing it differently than is San Diego State. Houston's throwing the ball most of the time. So we have two teams, a clash of styles. Houston also plays up-tempo. They're in the top 25 in the country in tempo. San Diego State, one of the 10 slowest teams in the country. So San Diego State's looking to run the football, keep the opposition's offense off the field. Houston's trying to get this into a high-scoring game. I think it's a really interesting game. The only side I would have here would be San Diego State. I'd want to get 3.5 points. You know, you're sitting three now with some juice on Houston. 66% of the bets are on Houston so far and 55% of the money on Houston. I think there are some signs in the market of the sharps wanting to take San Diego State in this spot. I want to take San Diego State, too, if it gets to 3.5 or 4 points. I think the public's going to want to take Houston in this one. So I think it probably will go up to 3.5 because, you know, the public knows Houston a lot better than they know San Diego State.
Well, we've seen a pretty significant total move on this game as well. This total opened 60 at Bookmaker, now sitting 54.5, 55. And you mentioned there with this Houston team, you know, how good they are at stuffing the run. So we'll see if that big, heavy steam there on the total does come to fruition in the Las Vegas Bowl. Moving right along here to the Camellia Bowl, or Camellia Bowl, whatever the hell it's called. Appalachian State and Toledo, this one in Montgomery, Alabama. And this is a game that I don't think is going to get a whole lot of play and a whole lot of love. But of the five games here on Saturday, this is, I guess, six if we include the Celebration Bowl. But this is the one I'm most intrigued to see with Toledo as a short favorite.
Yeah, you're right about it. Probably not going to get very much love. You look at the number of tickets on the game so far. This one only has one-third of the bets that the Houston-San Diego State game has so far. So nobody really looking to bet this game, but I think it really is an interesting matchup. There's a few things about this game to me that make this a tricky game to handicap. Really, I like both teams. I would have liked to back both teams if they were matched up against somebody else. I really, really like this Toledo offense. I mean, Woodside has been tremendous. They obviously have a good running game. Appalachian State has two terrific running backs. Now, Appalachian State has a better defense, but when you go down and look through Appalachian State's schedule, I mean, who have they really played that had a good offense? Not very many of them. Toledo has a really good offense. The more I look at this game, the more I like to lean toward Toledo here. I think Toledo plays a little bit better competition in the MAC, and I think that Toledo's offense is going to be something like Appalachian State hasn't seen this year. So I like Toledo a little bit in this one. Nothing really to gauge from the market percentages, about 50-50 on both the bets and the money. So I'm not really sure how this one's going to move, but seeing only minus one at Chris right now, yeah, I'll lean toward Toledo in this one.
Are you worried at all about Toledo with the fact that they lost to Western Michigan there in that MAC West, you know, division championship game that sent Western Michigan to Detroit, and then, of course, you know, they go on to beat Ohio? Are you worried about Toledo for not, you know, being able to play in that MAC championship game, or do you feel like, you know, enough time passes that it's not really a big deal?
I mean, it's been quite a while, so I think Toledo can get up for this game. You know, it's not a team who who necessarily thought they'd be in a tremendous bowl game to start with. So I think that they'll still be up for the bowl game. I don't question their motivation level too much. What I do wonder is, you know, how's the Appalachian State defense going to do against Toledo? Appalachian State, no doubt, has been very good on defense so far this year. Like I said, I just don't think that they've really proven it against top-notch offenses. And Toledo is a very good offense. So I think Toledo is going to be able to move the ball on them. I do think Appalachian State will have some success running the football. You know, when you look at this total, I made this total 58. So you're at 57.5, 58 points right now. I see no value on the total. Like I said, I do like Toledo at least a little bit here.
Well, and of course, for Toledo, it'll be an interesting situation because last year they had an interim head coach for the bowl game, who I believe was Jason Candle, who then became the head coach after Matt Campbell left. So, you know, they have a little bit more stability here in terms of the bowl prep period, and maybe that's something that winds up helping them. Here's a really intriguing game because we've had a lot of sharp money coming in on both of these teams here over the last few weeks. I mean, for UCF, money came in on them pretty much throughout the season because they were an 0-12 team last year. You know, they wind up going 6-6 and getting to a bowl game here this year. Arkansas State, co-winner of the Sun Belt Conference, and that was after they started 0-4 in non-conference, including a home loss to FCS Central Arkansas. And then they just rattled off a bunch of wins against the number. So UCF, about a 5.5, 6-point favorite here in this one. Looks like the initial lean from the sharp players is on the Sun Belt team, though, the Red Wolves.
Yeah, you know, UCF's playing in their home stadium here, so obviously a really big advantage for them. UCF had a really good season. Yeah, definitely, as far as the money, 54% of the bets on UCF, 66% of the money on Arkansas State. So a pretty big split here. So the sharps definitely like Arkansas State. I think that's more of a numbers grab than anything else. You know, I think in a game with a total that's set really low, you know, only 49 points, and I think that's a really solid total. Actually, 98% of the money so far is on the under. So we've had some really big money here come in on the under. It's moved it down only half a point here from 49.5 to 49. I think that total could push a little bit lower. But I think that in general, when you look at these two teams, Arkansas State, like you said, just a horrible start to the season. I mean, it's pretty amazing they're at this point. UCF, I mean, they're minus 20.2 yards per game this year. So they've been outgained overall. Their defense is much better than their offense. Actually, both teams. It's intriguing because both teams play fast, and they look – to push the tempo, get off a lot of snaps. But neither team very efficient on offense. Both teams good on defense, especially at stopping the run. So I think you could see a low-scoring game here. I really have no lean on the side at all in this game. If anything, I would play the under, I think. Like I say, you know, with both teams playing with tempo, it's a little bit tricky when the total is only 49 points. Pretty sure this is going to be a pass for me. I think both teams deserve credit for getting to this point. But no strong lean here.
And this one, of course, the Auto Nation Cure Bowl. I guess the last thing I'll ask you about here is, you know, something I sort of started talking about earlier in the segment is you've got these differences in levels of play in terms of the opposition for some of these matchups here. You definitely have one here. You have a Central Florida team that plays in the AAC. You know, now obviously it's you know, kind of the, a lot of people like to call it the sixth power conference. And they also played on the road at Ann Arbor against Michigan. For Arkansas State here, pretty weak schedule. They played an Auburn team that was, you know, not great early on in the season. Played Toledo, got blown out at home in week one. Played at Utah State. Utah State didn't have a very good year. And then in the Sun Belt, you know, they blew out Troy. Troy was in a terrible spot in that game, though. So, you know, big difference here in terms of strength of schedule. How does that factor in for you?
Yeah, that matters quite a bit. You know, I think that's why this line's where it is, and the fact that UCF playing at home, obviously. But, yeah, I mean, Arkansas State hasn't really proven anything against anyone good this year. And, you know, like I just said about Appalachian State, strength of schedule is very weak. Number one and two in strength of schedule that I'm looking at here for Arkansas State. So, you know, Arkansas State defense has been very good against Sun Belt teams this year. But how are they going to do against Conference USA? I mean, Auburn scored very, very easily on Arkansas State earlier in the year, and Auburn's offense is not exactly tremendous, and they weren't good at all going into that game. So, yeah, I mean, based on all that, if I had to take a side, I'd probably take UCS here. But I don't really like laying almost a full touchdown in a game that I think will be pretty low scoring.
Do you have bye points here during the bowl season? Because, you know, there are going to be some moves here on these games where, you know, maybe you are looking for something that goes against the sharp steam. I mean, if let's say that this is a number theoretically that comes down to, you know, 3.5 or 4. And I don't know if there's going to be that significant of a move. I don't know if there's going to be that much sharp action on it. But, you know, are you willing to play in the face of steam if it's off from your number?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. You know, if I feel strongly about a game, then certainly I'll play in the face of steam, especially this time of year, because I think some people are just looking to grab a number and then, you know, they'll push it back up. In this case, I don't really have a point that I really want to play this one at, though. Like I said, I feel this is one where I don't have a strong edge. I don't have a strong feeling about either team. I'd rather just sit back and watch this game and look for a better spot. I do set by points, though, for particular games where the line's not where I want it to be yet, but I keep checking it constantly to see if it'll get there.
Well, one more game coming up on Saturday here. This one, the R&L Carriers New Orleans Bowl between Southern Miss and Louisiana Lafayette, and actually Hattiesburg closer to New Orleans than Lafayette. So we'll see how these two fan bases travel for this one down in the Big Easy. And it's always intriguing when you get these destination types of bowl games. Of course, you've got Las Vegas. You know, Hawaii's a little bit pricey for people. The Bahamas a little bit pricey for people as well. But, you know, Orlando is a spot that people may travel to, go to Disney and all that. New Orleans, you know, one of America's great cities, a lot of great food options, that type of thing, good party atmosphere. So, you know, I'd be curious to see what the crowd looks like for this game. But pretty much one-sided steam here on Southern Miss, now up to a 3.5 and even a 4-point favorite at some shops.
You know, this is an interesting game because Southern Miss, yeah, 62% of the bets and 62% of the money on Southern Miss here. So not a surprise that the line's going up. I think it'll probably go up a little bit more too. You know, my lean is Southern Miss here, but I can't play Southern Miss because, you know, I've talked about them so many times this year as far as misleading scores. Look at Southern Miss, 6-6 on the year, and yet they're up 141.2 yards per game on the year. So they've been outgaining the opposition by a ton, and yet they're only 6-6. They're 3-8-1 against the spread. Southern Miss is 0-7 against the spread when losing the turnover battle this year. They've done that a lot of times, and that's why they've been burning money so far this year. Lafayette, though, a weak offense. I mean, they have to be able to run the football to be able to move the ball here. Very little passing game. You know, this is a game where Southern Miss clearly has a higher upside than does Lafayette. But do you really want to trust Southern Miss? Because what they've done all year is move the ball up and down the field and turn it over in the red zone. You know, I don't have enough to go on that to think that Southern Miss or to feel confident that Southern Miss has done anything to change that. Southern Miss did end the season with a nice win, so I'll give them that. But like I say, you know, it's really tough to back a team that has lost the turnover battle so badly, minus 15 in turnovers overall this year.
Well, and for Southern Miss, that win against Louisiana Tech, Louisiana Tech had absolutely nothing to play for. It was kind of a Wyoming and San Diego State scenario where they were already in the conference championship game. So, you know, they weren't going to go balls to the wall to do anything in that regular season finale. So that game actually got Southern Miss into a bowl. Now for Lafayette, they beat Louisiana Monroe 30-3 on the road to get back into a bowl game. And you know, that was a rivalry game for them. So do you put any additional stock in that? I mean, how teams finished up the regular season, because this is a Southern Miss team that before covering against Louisiana Tech in a game that the Bulldogs didn't care about, Southern Miss had dropped 6 straight games against the number. So they were not playing particularly well. They backed into a bowl game basically.
Yeah, Southern Miss has had some pretty major injury issues. So to be fair to them, you know, they played a couple of those games without their top couple quarterbacks. So Southern Miss has just been a disappointing team overall this year. I mean, if you look at where they've been in the past, the fact that they're 6-6 on the year, definitely a disappointment. And like you say, I think that was a good point that in their last game, they beat a Louisiana Tech team who didn't really care about that game. Now, the way they beat them, I think, was still a little bit impressive, so I'll give them some credit for that. Lafayette, you know, Monroe is a really weak team, so it is a rivalry game, and winning that big impresses me somewhat. But you know, Monroe is definitely not a good team at all. These teams are pretty even as far as strength of schedule this year. You know, if I had to, I guess I'd lay the points with Southern Miss. But, again, this is one where I really don't like to play very much. I might play the total over as a slight lean here as well. I think Southern Miss will probably be able to score quite a few points on Lafayette, unless they turn it over constantly in the red zone. And I do think Lafayette can get the running game going here some against a Southern Miss defense who's not been tremendous against the run.
Well, and you alluded to this with San Diego State in the final game for Donnell Pumphrey, final game for Elijah McGuire at Louisiana Lafayette. So, you know, he's a guy that's had a very, very good collegiate career. Maybe the players do rally around him. Certainly you would think his offensive line would. And this is also a guy that, you know, another thing here is individual motivation with scouts in the crowd. You know, these guys want to get taken in one of the seven rounds of the draft or at least impress somebody enough to be an undrafted free agent. So a lot of guys with a lot on the line here, especially in these early bowl games, you know, they're coming from smaller schools. One more bowl game to hit on here. We'll hit on this one because we won't have a whole lot of lead time on next Monday's show. The Miami Beach Bowl, this one at Marlins Park, so one of, what I believe, five games to be played at baseball stadiums during the bowl season. Maybe there are six. But I think this is a really good segue into our college basketball segment because we talk a lot about pace wars. And in terms of pace wars here for the bowl season, this is probably the most notable example.
Yeah, it is. Tulsa second in the country in pace this year. Central Michigan likes to play really slowly. Central Michigan's been a disappointment. You know, just looking at my tempo ratings, Central Michigan's in the bottom 15 in the country, so definitely a big pace war here. Central Michigan, I feel like what happened with Central Michigan, and maybe I'm curious to see what your thought is on this, but Central Michigan was a team that I thought could be pretty good going into the season. I remember backing Central Michigan against Oklahoma State. Obviously, they won outright. They were fairly sizable underdog. I can't remember exactly. I think it was about 17 points or something like that. They went outright on the fluke call that they shouldn't have won that game. Central Michigan then from that point on really had a disappointing season. I feel like that's one of those spots where they go to Oklahoma State and they beat somebody good and then they think they've really done something and then they get in MAC play and it's disappointing. I feel like they hit their peak way too early in the season, and then it was downhill from there. I don't know. Do you feel like that sometimes that can be a situation where some of these smaller teams can go to a big school, win, and then after that it's just kind of downhill because they maybe not quite as motivated. They think they're pretty special.
No, I think that's a really excellent point, especially if you're a small school that – doesn't have a top-level coach in terms of the Group of Five leagues. I mean, not that John Bonamigo's been bad at Central Michigan. I think he's actually been, you know, pretty decent overall, especially given kind of the weird circumstances with Dan Enos going to become a coordinator. But I think if you don't have that head coach that can keep you focused on the task at hand, I think it makes it really, really difficult. Also for Central Michigan, I mean, they kind of ran into a tough part of the schedule going to Virginia. They gave up 49 points to Virginia, and Virginia's terrible. So that's not really a great showing for them. But then having to play Western the next game, I mean, that just sort of kind of that kind of put their MAC schedule into a bit of a tailspin too.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it certainly wasn't a good spot for them after that. And you know, the way Western Michigan beat them up, I think it was hard for them to come back from that. You know, Cooper Rush is a good quarterback for Central Michigan, although he's been a little bit of a disappointment this year. I think the supporting cast around him is not really that good now. You know, Tulsa's offense has gotten better throughout the year, and also Tulsa's defense is a lot better than it was last year. You know, this Tulsa defense was among the worst in the country last year, and this year they're certainly not good on defense, but they're a lot better than they have been in the past. Giving up 5.51 yards per play, which is actually 52nd in the country out of 128 teams. So Tulsa's gotten much, much better on defense than they were in the past. Central Michigan giving up 5.62 yards per play. On offense, 5.88 yards per play for Central Michigan, 6.09 for Tulsa. Tulsa's a really balanced offense. They're not necessarily like some of these other teams who play really quickly in that they want to always throw it around. They can run the football. They can throw it. I kind of like Tulsa in this game. I lean at the lay the points. I know it's quite a few points, but I think Tulsa is really finishing the season strong. Central Michigan, not so much. What I like even better, though, I like the over in this game. This may be my favorite one that we've talked about so far. So it's quite a few points, but I think Tulsa gets ahead in this one. And then I think Central Michigan has to speed up a little bit and throw it quite a bit. So I think you see quite a few points in this game, probably some big plays here. You know, obviously it's a situation where it's going to be a fast track. You know, there's not going to be anything slowing down the offenses. I feel like Central Michigan's offense can make some big plays here. Like I said, I think Cooper Rush is a good player. I think Tulsa's defense is certainly improved, but still not a great defense. And in general, I think that Tulsa is going to break some big runs and have some big passes here. Tulsa is sixth in the country in yards total offense this year. So, and 41.4 points per game. I feel like this is going to be a high-scoring game here.
Hey, you've got Tulsa here laying about 12 if you're looking in terms of the side. And, you know, look at Tulsa's body of work this year. I mean, they got blown out at Ohio State, but that's a really misleading game because they threw a couple pick sixes right before halftime in some awful, awful weather conditions. They lost 48-3, but that was a game that they were in heading into halftime before they had those two really crippling turnovers. They lost by 7 at Houston and catching 23 points, and they lost by 2 at Navy, and by then the books had already caught up to them. But, you know, I mean, we saw the season that Navy had obviously didn't end well for them, but this is a Tulsa team that, you know, I don't know if they've gotten enough respect here throughout the season based on their body of work. And, you know, I mean, I think that maybe now when you look at this bowl number, they are getting a little bit of that respect. So those are the 6 bowl games coming up before we talk again. Then we've got some Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Monday action to talk about on next week's segment. So, you know, we'll keep the bowl games coming. But for now, we'll flip over to the college basketball side here, go with our handicapping the hardwood segment for about 20 minutes or so. You know, obviously with so much emphasis on bowl season, so much emphasis on the end of their NFL regular season, probably not a whole lot of people digging too deep into college basketball at this stage of the game. But once the first of the year hits and we get into the NFL playoffs and college football is basically done at that point, you know, we'll start to get a lot more college basketball action. So what we want to do here with today's segment, we want to set you up for success with that, talk about a couple of long-term things, and also look at some intriguing matchups here coming up this week, give you some idea of how you should be breaking down these college hoops games, and then, of course, give you some idea of how Kyle breaks down these college basketball games as well. So I'll let you decide, man. Where do you want to start for today?
Well, I want to talk about a topic that I think can be really helpful to bettors and listeners. You know, I thought about this last night as I was making my notes for the games here. I think something that would be really good to talk about for these segments here would be home court advantages and kind of under-the-radar home court advantages. So I put together 3 under-the-radar really good home court advantages that you need to keep an eye out for this year based on the numbers in the past and my numbers, how much I give a team for home court advantage. And I'm willing to give out some of that information for sure. And I think another good topic that we can use for future references is maybe talk conference by conference in future weeks as far as teams where a home court advantage is really good and teams where they don't really have that much of a home court advantage. So here I'm just going to talk about 3 teams under the radar that have some really good home court advantages. Number 1 in the database as far as home court advantage, the Denver Pioneers. I know this doesn't surprise you, Adam. You know, you play in altitude like they do. That's a huge advantage. The other thing that's important to remember here is that they also have teams in their league that go a really, really long way to play them at Denver. I mean, look at Fort Wayne and IUPUI, for example. So Denver is really sitting in a nice spot in these home games here. Denver, if you look through the data, it's justified to give them 6.5 points for home court advantage, and that's a really big number. I think on average, my average home court advantage is 3.5 points. So 6.5 points for home court is definitely really big. That's the biggest I give anybody for home court advantage. It's justified because Denver, like I said, plays a lot of teams who have to go a long ways, and they're playing in the altitude. And nobody else is really used to playing in the altitude except for Denver. That's really important. And I think that the home court advantage could get even bigger now that they're playing faster under Rodney Billups. We'll keep an eye on that one as we go. But it's something that I'm watching to see if I need to give them even more than 6.5 points because, you know, you play at a faster pace. Theory, it should help you even more there.
So I know that we talked about the pace difference for Denver here this season on a previous segment, or maybe you and I talked about it off the air, but you did keep it the same for now, and you're going to take that wait-and-see approach because, I mean, for those that don't know, Denver used to be one of the slowest teams in the country. I mean, it was worse than watching paint dry to watch some of their games because they were using the entire shot clock every trip down the floor. Now, as you mentioned, you know, they kind of picked up the pace a little bit. So you kept it the same for now, but, you know, you certainly think that really it's only going to go up in terms of increasing the tempo, right? Their home court advantage wouldn't go down.
Yeah, I mean, it shouldn't go down unless you think that Rodney Billups isn't as good of a coach or for some reason that affects the home court advantage versus what Joe Scott did in the past. I will say that Denver hasn't played as fast these last few games, so I'm kind of keeping an eye on that one. They've let some of the teams that they've played here recently really slow them down a lot. So we're going to see how committed they are to that pace change. And that's part of the reason why I didn't move it from 6.5 points, because it's really easy for teams to talk about playing fast. I want to see them do it on a consistent basis. Their last three games have all been at a much slower pace than their games were earlier in the season. So we'll see how committed they are to it. Now, they do play a pretty long homestand here starting Saturday the 17th. So they're going to play a lot of games at home. I think there could be some good situations to back Denver because they haven't played all that well of late. They did win at Air Force and at Weber State. So some credit there because those are two decent teams. So, you know, I don't think Denver's rated too highly. And I think that this could be a team who could be a pretty good against the spread candidate to back here in the next few weeks.
All right. So who's the second team on your list then?
Well, the second team, they come from Missouri Valley Conference. And to be honest with you, you could fill a really long list of great home court advantages with just a bunch of MBC teams. But Evansville Purple Aces. Evansville, you got to give them either 5 or 5.5 points. You know, Evansville really has a great home court. When you look at this, you got to remember, the residents of Indiana really love college basketball. And one thing that I find when I look at home court advantage is every school in Indiana has a better home court advantage than most other teams. The fans get really into the game. Another thing that's important about Evansville is they do a great job attacking the rim. This is something I talked about here in the past. They really attack the rim well, and they get to the line more often at home than on the road. Obviously, that's no real surprise. You know, referees are human, and when the home crowd's there going crazy, probably a little bit more likely to call the foul on the opposition and put Evansville on the line. So Evansville is a team that I think you should look to back at home. And times that I like to back them at home are when they've come off a bad loss on the road, you know, when the stock would be really low on them. I'll look to back them as a home favorite, laying a small amount of points, or a home underdog against some of the best teams in the conference. I think Evansville's a really, really tricky place to play.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about Evansville, I think, off the air, you and I, because they lost some of their key players from last season. It seemed like they might be down a little bit, but they've been doing a better job of recruiting here recently as well. And, you know, I mean, having a home court advantage is great. You also have to have the talent to back it up. And, you know, this is an Evansville team that could be pretty dangerous in the MVC again.
Yeah, I mean, they don't have the talent that some of the very best teams do, but they're definitely the second tier. I mean, they're certainly a good team there in the Missouri Valley Conference. And overall, that's certainly a good conference. I just think that Evansville will be a good team to play at home in certain situations. Like I say, I would really look to back them when they've been having some ugly games before that, because I think it's a good spot for them to go home and get things right. The third team that I wanted to point out, this one is way, way under the radar, and you know I love these, Sacramento State. So Sacramento State's 2-7 on the year so far. They haven't played a home game against a Division I opponent, though. So, you know, we'll see how good they are at home going forward. I think there could be some good spots to back them, because obviously they've played so poorly. Now, if you look at Sacramento State, they play in, quote, the Nest. Their arena holds 1,012 fans. Wow. I mean, that's crazy. That's the third smallest court in college basketball out of 351 teams. And I have to say, I think most of the high school courts around here hold more than 1,012 fans. So really, really small court. And this can really be helpful. That's one thing that people need to remember. You know, people think that when, you know, you build a place with 20,000 fans or something like that, that it'd be a bigger home court advantage. That's actually not usually the case. Usually these really small courts where the fans are right on top of everybody is where the best home court advantage is. So, you know, Sacramento State about 5 points for a home court advantage. Really, I think this is one of those where I wanted to talk about it, number one, because it's such a small place. It's just crazy. You know, you can barely fit 1,000 fans in there. Number two, they haven't played anybody at home so far this year that's been lined. So I think going forward, we're going to get some value on taking Sacramento State at home.
I know that was a team that you talked about a little bit last year as well. So I'm glad that you're bringing them back here, kind of coming full circle a little bit in terms of our handicapping the hardwood segments. And I have to think that another element of this for Sacramento State is that, I mean, the Big Sky Conference is spread out all over the place. You've got a team in North Dakota. Yeah. You've got Northern Arizona, Southern Utah. It's all over the place. But Sacramento State is kind of out there by itself a little bit. You know, I mean, there's no team in Oregon that I see here. You know, there's nobody else in California. So it's really, really spread out. But it's kind of off the beaten path a little bit in the sense that, you know, there's no other teams out that way.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely one factor as well. You know, I think Sacramento State has multiple things working in their favor. And like you say, you know, some of these teams are really far away. North Dakota, Montana State. You know, these are teams that are a long ways away. And you think of it as a guy who lives in Ohio, and anybody who lives on the East Coast, you think of Montana and California not really being that far apart because they're both on the West Coast. But that's a long ways from playing in Montana to going to Sacramento State. And I don't think it'd be a very easy place to get to. So I think that plays a role in it as well. That's something to keep in mind here as well, that when you look at home court advantages, one of the big things you want to look at is, you know, how good are the home fans? What kind of arena do they play in? And how is the travel to get there? You know, is there an airport nearby? Are they going to be taking a long bus trip? A lot of these teams are going to be taking bus trips. You know, not very many of them are going to be flying. So, you know, how tough is it to get there? How long of a time will they need to go before the game? You know, another thing to keep in mind here, and this kind of segues into the kind of the quick hitters injury notes that I put down here for this week, is keep in mind that this is now exam time of the year in a lot of places. So we have a really light schedule of games this week. And it can be really tough for teams to play on the road during this week because they've really had a lot of other things going on. So I think home teams have a little bit of value during this time of the year. You know, so that's something to keep in mind. It's just I don't really have any number that I can quantify it by, but I think that's the case when you look at the long term. I will say the favorites hit 56% in the past week. So favorites have really been covering at a high clip. The over hit at a 54.6 clip in the past week. If things normalize a little bit after the under was really successful early in the season, you know, I think it made sense for the under to be so successful early on. But also, you know, you can't have the under hitting at 55, 60% every single week. So, you know, things just kind of getting back to normal there.
I want to apologize to the students and the fans of the Portland State Vikings. There is a team in the Big Sky in Oregon, so I apologize for missing that. But let's go into those quick hitters here and talk about some of those injury news and notes that you want to mention.
So Hassan Martin's out indefinitely for Rhode Island. And, you know, I think URI can be really good this year. Maybe I had them rated a little bit too highly in the preseason based on how they've played so far, but I think they have a really high upside now that EC Matthews is back and healthy. But Martin is a really big loss for them. He's a really good shot blocker, a low post presence for a team that doesn't really have a lot of low post players. So I think Rhode Island's going to be hurting quite a bit without him. I know they struggled a little bit without him there against Houston the other day. Houston was without Devin Davis, a key player for them also. I think that in general, you want to wait till Rhode Island comes or until Hassan Martin comes back to be looking to back Rhode Island.
Yeah, Rhode Island was a team. You had them in your preseason top 25, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yeah, they're not in my top 25 now, but I do think that there's a pretty decent chance that they'll end in my top 25. I'm still pretty high on the team overall.
All right, what's the next injury note you've got?
Okay, I'll give you just a couple more here. Iona Deshaun Mutch He's missed the last couple games. He's taking 26% of the team's shots, so obviously the offense runs through him quite a bit. And then another note is Shadrick Casimir. I really don't know how to pronounce his name, so I'm sorry if I butchered that. But he's having his minutes limited until further notice. He's just been having nagging injuries. I was reading about this the other day. They're going to play him every game, which is kind of a unique spot, but they're not going to play him that many minutes. I usually don't see that. So keep an eye on that one for Iona. I think Iona has a really high upside there in that league, MAAC, but right now they're not at full strength. The other one I want to point out is Sindarius Thornwell for South Carolina. Definitely the best overall player for the team. He's suspended right now. Can they keep winning without him? And they get a good test here tonight on Monday night against Seton Hall. So I think we're going to find out quite a bit about South Carolina here pretty quickly.
Yeah, I actually wrote up that preview over at bangthebook.com. So for any of our listeners that want to check it out, please do. Seton Hall now up to 2.5. It was 2 when I wrote it, I believe. But Thornwell is the leading scorer, rebounder, and assist man for South Carolina. So I mean, that's a really significant loss. How many points did you make an adjustment for the Gamecocks without him?
Yeah, it's really hard to quantify this early in the season, but I think it's about 3.5-4 points difference for without Thornwell. He's a veteran leader for a team like them. I think South Carolina has a better supporting cast than they've had in the past, but I don't really know. I don't really know until I see them against a good team how well they can do without him. I know they're going to play good defense still. Can they still be good on offense? So far this year, they've been pretty good on offense. And on defense, they're going to be good. You know, Frank Martin's teams play really solid defense, but they have to have some sort of efficiency on offense to beat good quality teams. I'm not sure if they can do that without him, so kind of a wait-and-see approach for me, and I'll adjust as necessary.
So what else did you want to talk about here for our Handicapping the Hardwood segment? I know you said that there were a couple of games you wanted to mention.
Yeah, let's talk a couple games here this week. I want to talk a couple under-the-radar games. First of all, Wednesday, the 14th, we have Middle Tennessee and Belmont. This is a really nice little rivalry game. Middle Tennessee and Murfreesboro, Belmont, obviously a team from Nashville. Those places aren't even an hour apart, so these two teams know each other really well. Middle Tennessee, you have to say, they've done really, really good following up their shocking win against Michigan State in the NCAA tournament. Now they're 9-1 so far this year with only a loss at home to Tennessee State. They're just coming off a win over Vanderbilt last game a week ago. They beat Vanderbilt 71-48 at home, so very, very impressive. They also won on the road at Mississippi 77-62. So Middle Tennessee has had some really impressive wins so far this year. Belmont, a team that's, you know, consistently a good team and usually one of the best teams or the best team in the OVC. Belmont's been a little disappointing so far, and I was looking in depth at Belmont. The thing that's been the problem with Belmont so far this year is they're taking too many three-pointers. I mean, this team is shooting the 28th highest percentage of threes of anybody in the country out of 351 teams. And they're shooting only 28.5% on three-pointers. Now, obviously, that number is going to go up as far as the percentage because I think they do have some decent shooters. But Evan Brads is their best player, and he needs more paint touches. I'm going to be curious to see if that happens moving forward. I think it needs to for Belmont to have success. You know, when you have your best player down low and you're just out there chucking a ton of threes, I think you're hurting yourself a little bit. So we'll see if Belmont can make that adjustment going forward.
Is that something that matches up poorly then with Middle Tennessee? Do they defend the perimeter pretty well? Are they quality on the interior to keep Brads from being effective with those touches? How does this matchup shake out?
Yeah, Middle Tennessee is really good against the three-pointer. They have been throughout the years. I think Middle Tennessee is always pretty consistently in the top 60, 70 teams in the country defending the three-point line. Now, Middle Tennessee is a team that the strength of their team is taking care of the basketball. They're fifth in the country in least turnovers. So that's the strength of the team. The weakness of them, they don't shoot free throws well. They don't get to the line that often. They foul a little bit too much on defense. So, you know, you could say that Belmont might get to the line some if they could get it inside. But when you're out there shooting threes constantly, you're not going to get to the line very much. You know, like I say, this is a really good rivalry game. I think this game will be pretty close to a pick'em as far as the line. No real strong lean as far as who I'd like to play in this one. The next one we're going to talk about is my strong lean, but I do think that Both of these teams, Belmont and Middle Tennessee, are ones to keep an eye on moving forward. I think Belmont, if they can get it together and start getting the ball inside, can go on a good run, ATS in the OVC. And I think Middle Tennessee is going to continue to be a very good team this year throughout the rest of the season.
All right, so what's the next game that we're going to?
So I want to talk about Long Beach State and Oregon State. I believe that game, yeah, it's Friday night. Long Beach State, so this game, first of all, is at the Moda Center where the Blazers play. So kind of a home game for Oregon State, basically. But you look at Long Beach State, I mean, they always play that ridiculous road trip at the beginning of the season. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I like playing tough competition early in the year, and I like teams that schedule up. But, I mean, they were playing in 1 week, Wichita State on the road, North Carolina on the road, Louisville on the road, and UCLA on the road, all within the span of a week. Four games in a week. They got drilled in every game. They've played a little bit better of late, though, at Long Beach State. And now they're playing an Oregon State team who has some serious problems. I talked about them a couple weeks ago as far as an injury note. Trace Tinkle out. It really, really is hurting them badly. I mean, they just lost to Savannah State at home yesterday in overtime. That's a really embarrassing loss. And I have to say, I put these notes together before they lost to Savannah State. I really wish they hadn't lost to Savannah State because I really wanted to go against them here. I still believe I will go against them. I think Long Beach State will probably be favored, even though this is kind of a road game for them. And I think they should be favored. Oregon State playing some really, really bad basketball right now. Lost by 17 to Mississippi State, not a good team at all. Lost by 3 at Charlotte. And then losing in overtime at home to Savannah State, who hadn't really even been close to beating anybody D1 so far this year. And then they beat Oregon State on the road. I think that says a lot about where Oregon State's at. And I think this is a spot where Long Beach State, because they haven't had much success so far this year, I mean, you look at them, they're 2-10 on the year, but they're coming off a win over Pepperdine at home, and then they go to Texas and only lose by 6 points. I think they're starting to round into form a little bit here, and I think this is where we may see the benefit of Long Beach State playing so many good teams so far this year. You look at strength of schedule that they've played so far this year, first in the country. So I think that benefits them a lot here when they play against an Oregon State team that's really down without Trace Tinkle.
Well, and you mentioned it already. I mean, when you look at their schedule, they were alternating days with Wichita State, North Carolina, Louisville, had a couple of days between UCLA, but that's because they were taking a cross-country trip back to the West Coast, one day off before playing Washington, one day off before playing Binghamton, a back-to-back against Florida Gulf Coast. You know, they've gotten 5 days off by the time this game tips off. So this is a road-weary team that actually gets a chance to, you know, sort of recharge the batteries a little bit. And, look, I understand that they're playing really, really good competition. But if you're a player on that team, you look at your record, and you have 10 losses already. And that's, what, one of the most in the country. I don't even know if anyone else has double-digit losses yet. That's embarrassing for you. You know who you're playing, but it's still kind of a point of pride there. So you have to think that, you know, now that the schedule softens up for them, motivation is fully in Long Beach State's corner.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I want to back them here. Like I say, I think the value would have been a lot better if Oregon State hadn't just blown that game against Savannah State last night. But this will be my free pick for this week. I'm going to take Long Beach State in this one. You know, as far as the line, I think Long Beach State probably is favored by 1 or 2 points. If they're favored by something like 4 or 5 points, then I probably won't be playing it. I just want to kind of give people an idea of what to expect as far as the line, because obviously it has to be somewhat price-dependent. I can't just say I'm going to play a game no matter what. But as long as they're a short favorite, I'll take Long Beach State here.
Well, to update there on the teams with double-digit losses, there are two other ones. Coppin State is one. The other is Mount St. Mary's, who played, what, they've played 10 away games, 10 true road games, I think, here before they actually played a home game. So another team that's played a really, really difficult schedule here at the outset of the season. Did you have anything else on the college basketball side that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I want to talk about just real quickly. You know, we have to talk just a little bit about Kentucky and North Carolina on Saturday. You know, no strong feeling as far as who I'd back in this game. I do think Kentucky's a better team than North Carolina right now. And North Carolina coming off that game Sunday where they just edged out Tennessee, one thing I'll point out about that game is North Carolina really missed Joel Berry in that game. So he needs to be back for this game. I think he might be back by then, but keep an eye on that. You know, he has several days to rest. If he's not playing, I think Kentucky wins this game relatively easily because North Carolina certainly needs him. Now, the strength of North Carolina is offensive rebounding. It is that way almost every single year. And that is a weakness of Kentucky's. Really, their only weakness so far this year has been defensive rebounding. So you have to think that North Carolina is going to be able to hurt them there. One thing I think that will happen in this game is I think that there's going to be a really, really fast tempo. You know, Kentucky's looking to play as fast as possible. They're 10th in the nation in tempo so far this year, actually faster than North Carolina. North Carolina, 42nd in the nation in tempo. But, you know, when you watch North Carolina play through the years, you know, the next time that North Carolina slows a team down is going to be the first time I've seen them do it. So I don't really think North Carolina is going to try to slow the pace down. You know, where will this total be? Probably somewhere 164, 165, something like that. My strongest lean for this game would be the over. It is on a neutral court, so that's a little bit of a negative for the over. But I think there's going to be some real fireworks in this game. I think it should be a very exciting game to watch.
Pretty interesting slate on Saturday. You also have Purdue, Notre Dame, Ohio State, UCLA. You know, you've got that North Carolina, Kentucky game that you mentioned. Also Butler and Indiana. So pretty good slate of games on Saturday. So for our listeners out there, you know, make sure that you're tuning in for all this college basketball action. Kyle Hunter of HunterSportsPicks.com. What's going on over there at the website this week, man?
Well, you know, busy week, obviously prepping for all the bowl games. I wanted to say 13-1 in my last 14 football top play releases. The top-rated plays have done really well in general lately. 31-20 so far this year in college basketball. So a good run here of late. As far as college football, I have a top play up for Saturday. Like I said, 13-1 in my last 14 top play releases. So check that one out at the website. And also, if you haven't already, sign up for the free picks newsletter from HunterSportsPicks.com. 39-19 in my last 58 free plays.
At Kyle Hunter Picks on Twitter. Kyle Hunter, appreciate your time, man. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you again next week, bud.
All right. Thanks, man. Have a good one.
So a great segment there with a really, really strong professional handicapper and a good way to get this week going here on Bang the Book Radio. Coming up on Tuesday, we're going to have a show. However, we may not have a live broadcast. I'm working through some things here from a scheduling standpoint. We'll see what happens. But we will have a Tuesday show. Will be our Tuesday meeting show with Brian Leonard and Sports Cheetah. So nothing will change in that respect. But we just may not have a live stream. I'm going to have to see how things sort of play out with that. But you know, we'll let you know over on our Twitter feed at Bang the Book. But regardless, you know, even if it's not a live show, as long as you're subscribed to our channel, whether it's on iTunes or somewhere else, you know, you'll be able to get all of this information. But we will have Brian Leonard and Sports Cheetah coming up here on Tuesday. So that's it for today. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.